Right. Thanks for having us here. I've never been to Darwin before, so it's really nice to be over here. I originally come from Singapore, and so, yes, I reckon our climates are very similar. My first stop in Australia was in Tasmania, where I've stayed for about 9 years. I shared an office with Mark for a while, and I couldn't have a happier roommate. We were doing all things geeky together. So when he started on this research in the area of studying condensation for the state government, I was very happy to work together with him to put our brains together to see what we can do to solve this problem. So it turns out that mold is a big problem in Tasmania. So a lot of what I'll be talking here about has a Tasmanian context. That's only because we've done a lot of measurements in Tasmania. The larger framework applies across Australia, and I probably would like your feedback on to what are some of the problems you have seen in your careers that we can probably start to wrap our minds to understand better. Right. It turns out that mold is everywhere. When I started looking at mold in Tasmania, I started to find mold everywhere in Tasmania. This was the then housing minister under fire because we had this situation where the public housing was so poorly insulated, the homeowners had to choose between paying for their bills and paying for heating. Paying for the heating or paying for their food. So very often they would just go cold, and as a result of that, without enough heat, a lot of their things got below dew point and mold just took off. You might have heard the fiasco we have had with the Royal Hobart Hospital. We had a situation where the demountables were brought in as part of the hospital's extension program. They were left out in the dock for a period where they were exposed to weather. Part of the way it was detailed also had this problem because they had a steel skin outside polystyrene, so there's no cavity. So any moisture that builds up has no way of escaping. It builds up inside, it can't escape. So it keeps building up, the plasterboards all get moldy after a while. So even before they were installed, they were all moldy. Yep. A few years ago, we had a bushfire that went through the east coast of Tasmania. To the credit of the government, they rebuilt the schools within a few months. But they were also using demountables. So part of the problem is drainage. Part of the problem is using this standard detail where they have a steel skin outside polystyrene, not allowing the vapor permeability. The moisture builds up, has nowhere to escape. It reaches dew point, you get mold. A couple of years ago, early 2016, ABCB sent out a survey. You might have received this. They were asking all in the industry what they thought about the condensation problems across Australia. So UTAS was tasked to study this. I've left UTAS just a couple of months ago, so a lot of this research was done together with Mark during that time. So broken down by climate zones, this was the responses. We don't have a lot of responses from the warmer climates, not because there isn't a problem there, but because the market isn't all that big. The width of this violin plots show basically the response rates. So if we were to just average them across all the various climate zones, roughly about 1 in 3 buildings, the industry estimates, has a condensation problem. Once you've got a condensation problem, it is really just a matter of time. You're going to have a mold problem. This started to cause some alarm to the builders sometime after 2009, 2010. You see, the energy efficiency standards were introduced in 2003, took place in 2004. But 2009 and 10 was where they cranked up the standard a bit more, and we were moving on towards 6 stars. At the same time, in 2009, the Victorian bushfires introduced a new Australian standard, the one about bushfire attack levels. And one of the ways of dealing with that was to prevent cinders from blowing inside the roof spaces. The cheapest way of doing it was to put battens under the eaves so that it basically seals them off, no cinders can blow through. The result of that is also no ventilation takes place. So this was a house in Launceston a few months after completion. All the examples we are showing are houses that have gone through their first winter. So it doesn't really matter how soon they were created. Within 1 year, you're bound to have these problems because people don't understand condensation. So just within a few months, this particular roof had a big problem. You know how architects, and I am architecturally trained, so I'm speaking for myself and for my industry too, how architects have this passion for weirdly shaped roofs? You come across that all too often. Instead of having a gable roof, they would rather have two single pitch roofs. The problem with that is that if you've got a gable roof, the whole space can be heated up, regardless of which way you point your roof. Agree? Yep. One side is bound to be the north, the other side in the south, doesn't matter. One side gets warm, the whole space gets warm, you get to dry it out. You split the two roofs, one gets north sun, one gets the south. It never dries up. So this mono pitch roof was in the south. this particular place was above the laundry. That particular laundry didn't have a duct. So all the water that went out of the washing went into this roof space. So it didn't take very long at all for the whole place to be rotted out. This was a few months after occupation. So what we've been doing in all this is that we've been doing a bit of measurements, and we're trying to get down to the root of the problem. So what I'm going to say is very specific to the Tasmanian context, but I hope that the science will take us a bit further so we can understand how that applies into other places as well. So over in the northern coast of Tasmania, in Burnie, we had this house that had this constant wetness in the ceiling, in the roof. Mark showed you the time lapse that we did there, and we found that that roof never dried out. One of our pet peeves is downlights. The problem with downlights is that you can't put insulation over them unless you separate the power supply from the LEDs. If you're using the halogen, there's no chance. You've got to put a sleeve, a collar around it so the insulation stops before it hits the lights, because it's going to overheat otherwise. When that happens, you've got a cold bridge. So you've got a cold roof, warm living space, and you've got a damp downlight that drips all the time. This particular downlight was over the master bedroom bed. So you're an owner waking up to a wet bed every morning. There was a southern window, double glazed, not thermally broken. It being not thermally broken was enough to have so much condensation that it dripped across the whole window pane, and that area was constantly wet. In the south of Tasmania, towards Hobart, in this place called Molesworth, the owner was cleaning the house every day. In the place where she couldn't reach behind the child's bed, she pulled it out, and after a few weeks, this was what was happening. There was that much mold there. It was probably about a centimeter thick in terms of the mold growth. The same house on the other side, there was something that Mark showed earlier on. When we peeled back the color bond cladding, peeled back the foil, we could see that the insulation was all wet. What happens was that because there was no cavity, it was hard fixed. You have the color bond hard fixed to the wrap. That creates a cold spot. The warm air in the living migrates out, hits there, hits dew point, it starts causing that damp, causes the thermal bridging to become even worse because the insulation has lost all its R value, so it gets wetter and wetter. The bottom cords are all rotting out within a few weeks after occupation. Another area that people often forget is roofs, ceilings where they have different angles. So in this particular ceiling, there was part of it that was raked, and the other part of it was flat. The problem was that you have a wall across there, and the builder doesn't think that the wall is a ceiling. You see the problem? If the wall isn't a ceiling, they don't think that that needs R4 insulation. They don't insulate it at all. So you've got the warm air from the living hitting the cold roof of the ceiling. This is the other part of the ceiling where it's reaching the bracing. So it's cold air of so some of the air inside here, though it's not very cold, but because the bracing has got no R value inside there, that cold plywood gets the plywood gets cold, reaches below dew point, you get mold. And all this was after a few weeks after the owners occupied the space. Now I'd like to delve a bit deeper into this, so I'm just going to go through these graphs. So bear with me in this. I think that we got to go both broadly and deeply, but we'll just do this sufficiently for us to get a grip of the problem. Now when you see these things, if you're geeky, you start hyperventilating. I see no geeks around here. You're starting to glaze over. I'll try to inspire you, all right? So the first line we see is, that is the living room temperature. Now what you see, the first thing you see about that is that it is really jagged. And it tells you a few things. One is that there is not quite enough insulation, so there's way too much feedback between the outside and the inside. If you put the outside temperature into the graph, you can see that the profiles match each other quite closely. There is not enough insulation to keep the two profiles quite distinct. So this house is probably flawed in the way it's insulated. Next thing I want to put across is, you can barely see it, but that's the outdoor dew point. So there are times where the outside temperature goes below its dew point. I'm going to plot that by showing the delta. So I'm taking the delta between the dew point and the outdoor temperature. So every time we go below zero, that's where condensation is happening. So on a daily basis, we can expect that condensation is going to happen. So what we never try to tell people is that we can guarantee that condensation does not happen, right? We can actually guarantee you, regardless, condensation is going to happen. Can we manage it properly? Now, what does this show us? It shows us that there's going to be condensation happening on all the surfaces that get to that condition. So particularly something to note is that if your roof is ventilated, you're going to have outdoor air coming into there that is going to be below dew point. So there's no escaping. The roof is going to be a place where condensation happens. Now, this is where I have difficulty telling architects. I teach architectural students, and they are not the most mass and science savvy. But if you could just exert a bit more pressure on them and tell them that, look, your roof is going to have condensation problems. And I was just talking to Rob just a while ago. Places like Alice Springs, you've got nighttime heat losses and so forth. Your roof gets really cold. So you should be expecting that, yes, you're going to be expecting roofs to get below dew point. Now, if your drainage under your roof doesn't get to the gutter, if your roof pitch is too shallow, those droplets grow and grow and grow, and they just keep dropping back onto your ceiling. So straight away, you're going to have that problem. There's no escaping it. You need a pitched roof. Otherwise, you need an engineered solution. It's that straightforward. An engineered solution is not just putting one layer of sacking. It's about 9 layers. You've got to put huge amounts of anticons, ash grit, and so forth just to make the flat roof works. So one designers, if they want a flat roof, it's got to be an engineered solution. They can't just use off-the-cuff roofing manuals. Let's go on. This shows the temperature of the roof. And you see it's drastic. There are times we go below freezing points. So you don't just get condensation in the roof, you get frost. And this is when we're putting the sensors under this product called Anticon. So it's a foil blanket, so it's got beds with aluminum foil glued on. So we're putting our sensors where the battens were squishing into the roofing. So that's where the Anticon was the tightest. And at those points, you're finding that, yes, not only does the Anticon not prevent condensation, it doesn't even prevent frost. So despite what the marketing says, we've got to be very careful. The numbers show us, we showed this to CSR, and to their credit, they have put Anticon off the Tasmanian market. They actually didn't have to, because I think used correctly, it can have its application. But I think they looked at the labor force and said that, look, you guys don't know what you're doing. We just pull the product out and free ourselves of the headache. But yeah, here's to tell you that if the foil blankets are installed, you cannot prevent condensation. You're still going to get it.
Every other manufacturer has now sold more foil products since CSR took theirs out. So the ethical manufacturer did the right thing. The other manufacturers in sales didn't.
Now I'm going to put the roof dew point into this, and this you really must look at it and appreciate, because we fright so many of our RH sensors putting them into the roof spaces because it was dripping wet. We were just like soaking them into a swimming pool. We fried a few $400 sensors. So for us to collect this data was involved a lot of personal sacrifice. Right, so we see, once again, we're going to get the roof well below dew point even when you've got an insulated bed installed on the underside of the roof. So over and over again, you're going to see that, yes, it's below dew point, condensation happens. So our point to you is that condensation is going to happen. We can't prevent it. Can we manage it? So that brings us into a totally different issue now. If condensation is going to happen, so what? Feel free to answer me. I love my class to interact. So mold. So what? She'll be right, mate. Just use mold killer. Paint over her, she'll be right. You see the problem? We know that we've got a condensation problem. We know there is no escaping this. The condensation could lead to mold, but we don't have a standard that tells us how much condensation leads to how much mold. How much mold becomes how much of a health issue. So we're kind of hanging loose here. There are some loose ends here, and until that is sorted out, it's left to industry best practice. I'm afraid that that's all it boils down to. Our mission around here is to get you guys right on top of these issues. We are not close enough to the coal face of this to get it implemented. We try to influence ABCB, the lawmakers and so forth. But we need people like you on the ground to actually influence the actual implementation of this. So yes, looking at what's happening, this is what the profile looks like. All the air comes from the outdoors. So it's not the outdoor air, it's being heated up. When it heats up, this is a fascinating thing. I am not a big RH fan, but you notice that the RH tapers down around the 50-60% mark. So for whatever reason in our measurements, we have found that when we plot a distribution curve, the internal RH usually stays around 60%. It has to do with all the hybrid buffering of the plasterboard and so forth. You've got more moisture than there, they absorb it. If it gets drier than there, it releases it. So it always stays somewhere around the 50-60% mark. So that's a handy rule of thumb. If you don't have an RH sensor, assume 60% intensity. I've got to measure it here to find out. What's happening in the roof is that dead air gets cooled and heated up inside the roof space during the daytime. During the evenings, it gets cooled into saturation. And so there we have a lot of these problems happening. Now, this is the opposite of what's happening in Darwin. We are getting a problem with what we call cool roofs. So let me just plot to you. This is the data from the Australian Solar Radiation Data Handbook for Launceston, somewhere in the north. So that's about, let's say, 8 megajoules per square meter of solar radiation during the month. I'm doing this so that when I plot the bomb data for this particular site in Burnie, you can see that this is an above average day, that is a below average day. And these are the solar temperatures that we measured in this house. Not a very distinct behavior. It looks like despite what the solar radiation is doing, the roof is doing pretty much its own thing. The color of this roof is white. So white roofs are actually a major problem in Tassie. Now, white roofs work perfectly in Darwin, I reckon, but over in Tassie, because they are cool, they stay cool. And when they stay cool, you don't allow the roofs to recover. You remember we started off with the premise, condensation is going to happen. Does it recover? If you don't give it a chance to recover, we're kind of stuffed. And now the interesting thing, all that heat didn't come from the sun. It looks like it came from the living room spaces. So the sun doesn't do very much. It is really the heat pump keeping the roof warm. Now we saw the time-lapse of this. I'm just going to capture a few times, 6 a.m., noontime, 6 p.m., midnight. And what you're seeing is that the droplets form and they stay there. They don't dry up. They just dangle there and then they build up again and they start dropping again. You can also see this as a clip lock, so it's got a flat profile and then a bit of a ridge, a flat profile. You can see where that's running down, because where it's in contact, there's where you're getting the condensation. And that gives you an idea that where there's no condensation, even that bit of cavity can save your roof. We are teetering at the edge of condensation. Every little bit we do to prevent it helps. So don't underestimate everything we're doing. Right, and that's just a profile of the temperatures that we record. Now this was when we were flying over the north coast of Tassie. I just looked out the window, I thought, oh, that was a gorgeous shot. Being geeks, we look at this and we ask, where is condensation happening? So romantic, isn't it? And the point I want to tell you is that these things only make sense after we see it. It's really hard to predict where a cloud is going to form. But after you see all the clouds forming over the over the land area, you've got this figured out. There's transpiration of the trees giving out a lot of moisture. The warm area, the land is heating up faster than the sea. That air, the stack effect is rising faster, goes through the adiabatic elapsed rate, reaches dew point, and you get the clouds forming there. Now, after you see the picture, it becomes clear. But if you tell me to look at a building and predict where it's going to happen, that gets really tricky. After we see where all the mold goes, you say, ah, now I can give you an explanation for that. But to predict beforehand, we actually find that this is really, really tricky. So don't look at us as if we can predict the future. We are really just forensic scientists looking into this and seeing that, yeah, this is where it's a problem. I think I can give you an answer for that. Now, this is from the DA20 manual we've got over here. You probably got a copy of it. It's a good start. But I need to also explain that this is not the whole picture. So to understand how you look at this, we are starting with this premise that condensation has an impact that goes beyond just water, right? Water has its trouble. It causes wood to swell, for example. It causes nail plates to move out of joint. So those have their own problems. But primarily, the big issue we're concerned about is mold. So we've got to see how does condensation affect mold. The way you read this is that looking at the RH, so an RH of, say, for example, 75% and Darwin's, 75% RH and Darwin, let's say the average temperature is about 25, it would take roughly 16 to 32 days before the mold starts sporulating. So it's a bit like if you have got seeds, you plant them, they don't sprout straight away, they've got a gestation time. So mold has that too. So depending on the amount of moisture, we are saying that it gestates at different rates. And after that, what is the growth rate? So if we keep that at 75% RH and about 25 degrees Celsius, it grows at about 0.01 millimeters per day. Now that's not very fast, but what you have is that you have a constantly suitable temperature for mold to actually grow. So all you need to do is just add water. Now, How does our research come back into this? We were measuring RH into the living spaces. Remember the particularly moldy house with all that mold growing behind the child's bed? We were measuring that, and I'm drawing lines at 0.75 at the bottom, and never does the RH touch that line. Yet, when we took samples around and we passed it to our microbiologist, he was giving us all these fancy names. They are basically all horrific things. Mark showed you a list of mold that are outdoor, commonly found, Cladosporium, Alternaria, and so forth. So that's Alternaria, that's Cladosporium. So these things are common outdoor molds. But we are just looking at them under a microscope. Under all of these things, it's like if you're on the moon and you're trying to identify a forest in Australia and you're looking through a telescope, all you can see is that that is like a pine forest and that is like a eucalypt forest. So what we're seeing under the microscope is looking them at to the level of genera. So we haven't speciated them yet. You need to go down to the species to be able to know whether they're harmful or not. So for a start, what we'll suggest is that it is a bit like cancer. You don't ask what color is your cancer tumor. If you've got cancer, get rid of it. If you've got mold, get rid of it. Don't even bother about identifying it. If you've got mold, you've got a problem. Right? You start out with this, guys. They are called the primary colonizers. You leave it for longer, you get the secondary colonizers. Then you get the tertiary colonizers. The tertiary colonizers are the stuff of nightmares. Right? You get them into your lungs and they will grow there. Yeah, you get fungal balls inside you. Start bleaching out blood and so forth. Yes, a bit dramatic, but yes, it's... Don't trust me. Check out Aspergillus. And then you look at this thing called the curse of the mummy. You see, what happens is that when the mummies were entombed, they tried to dry them out. But one of the species that could grow very well was the Aspergillus. And they grew there. So the tomb raiders that went to these places and then they exposed the tombs, the Aspergillus went into their lungs and started having black veins and coughing out blood. So yes, this is the stuff of nightmares. They call it the curse of the mummies, but really it's just all mold. All right, back to our story. We're finding all these molds there, and our RH seems to be okay, 75%. So something doesn't fit, right? So a house can be moldy even when the RH is under 75%. So we dug deeper and we found that really when it comes to studying mold, building scientists aren't at the cutting edge. The people that are at the cutting edge are food scientists. To them, they've got to look at this issue very carefully. And they give us this formula for water activity. Now, it is really the measure of how much energy is left in the water after it is bound in a different matrix. So for example, water is kind of free. The moment you put it into a sponge, its energy level drops because some of the energy goes into binding it into the lattice structure of that. And the proof of that is you've got to squeeze the sponge for the water to come out. So obviously it's at a lower level. So gypsum board, all these materials, any permeable material, any porous material can hold some water. And if you look at the temperature of that sample against the temperature of the dew point of the air, you can work out what it is. So the way you look at this is that when this approaches zero, the exponent of zero becomes one, you get water activity of one, meaning that you get free water, you get condensation happening on the surface. But we need to be involved with what's happening in the materials, not what's happening in the air. So RH doesn't give you the whole picture. So when people tell me that, look, you can manage mites in your dust, mites in your pillow by measuring RH, I say that that's not true, because the mites grow in a micro environment of the pillow. You need to study the pillow, not the RH of the air. So similarly, we're going to look at the water activity of carpets, of gypsum boards, of ceilings for us to know what's going on. So back to this whole picture, when we put inside other data, things like the external temperature, factor in thermal bridging. So I'm just going to draw this out. So on the outside, we've got a color bond. We've got the wrap hard fix on that. At the bottom, we've got a bottom plate. Our insulation runs across there. And here we've got plasterboard, right? Now we can assume that the temperature on both sides of the color bond is going to be the same. Both sides of the membrane is pretty much going to be the same too. We've got an issue here. Any vapor that comes across here condenses on there and it starts building up. Once it builds up, that R value goes close to zero. The whole thing becomes a conductor. Next thing, the skirting board is where you're going to see mold growing. So it is not far-fetched to use outdoor temperature as an indicator for water activity. Put that in, and what do we see? Not only do we breach 0.8, where most moles start, we go past 1. So now you've got free water. When you've got free water, everything grows. I've been working with my students to see how we could actually get this data across to more people widely, and we needed to actually take a few steps back to say, so what, so what, so what? Now, the first issue for our so what is that, is there a health implication to mold? And our ladies right up front, if there is no health impact, then there is no problem with mold. Just paint over it. It's just aesthetic. But if there is a health issue, we need to be aware of it and to start raising awareness about this issue. Now, we're starting off with this. From our ABCB survey, about 1 in 3 houses we estimate have a problem with condensation. Once you've got condensation and you don't diligently dry that out, you're going to have a mold problem. The other thing is that this comes from one particular researcher in the US, Richie Shoemaker. He himself suffers from mold illness and has been researching this for a long time. And I say he's just one out of 1,000 medical researchers who understands mold illness. Many, many doctors actually don't. But what he has come up with is that based on your genes, you are likely not able to get rid of the biotoxins that come from mold. So they keep accumulating in your system. So you don't get sick straight away. It builds up in your system to the point that you are under this thing called chronic inflammation. So that chronic inflammation leads into other issues that are not so straightforward in that they are not a single organ or a single symptom. 1 in 4 of the population would have the genes that lend you to this. And you can test this quite easily. It's just a blood test. You can go to Darwin Pathology or any of those labs. It is a simple blood test. They're looking for certain markers. The markers they're looking for is this thing, the HLA, human leukocyte antigen, DR and DQ gene test. There are a total of 6 genes there. Any one of them could be problematic. If you have so much as 2 of them, you are very much predisposed to mold illness. So even though 1 in 4 of us would be predisposed to this, probably about 1% are extremely sensitive to mold illness, in the sense that if they go to moldy buildings, straight away they'll flare up, they'll get all this, they'll get a variety, probably most of the symptoms. Respiratory problems and asthma, that's quite widely understood. Diarrhea happens because your inflammation is such that you are not digesting your food properly, your bowels are irritated. Headaches and migraines because of the inflammation, once again, restricting the blood flow, and then you're getting those migraines. Chronic fatigue. A lot of the chronic fatigue is actually misdiagnosed to the Epstein-Barr virus. It's actually more likely to be mold illness.
Can you say that again about the Epstein-Barr virus?
Chronic fatigue. It's probably misdiagnosed. It's wrongly attributed to the Epstein-Barr virus. It is actually more likely to be mold illness. So I'm on this group called Toxic Mold Support Australia, and people have been repeatedly misdiagnosed. When they started to avoid certain buildings, they found themselves improving much more. So it is not to do with the virus. It is to do with all sick buildings. And a lot more. Yeah.
Thank you. You
discovered something? Feel free to just email me if you want the slides. I'm more than happy to give them out, so just sit back and pay attention. So people ask me, can it be all in your head? And the argument is that, is it all self-made up illnesses? And look, some of it can be in your head. The more I read about this, the more I started to suspect I had those symptoms. The more I talked to Mark about this, the more he thought he had brain fog from a result of all our mold explorations. But there are objective tests. I mentioned about the blood test. If you've got those genes, you've got a problem. The NeuroQuant is a volumetric MRI. They scan your brains because this chronic inflammation affects your brains and it shrinks it in a very specific way. So yes, moldies, so-called, have shrunken brains as compared to a healthy person. And they are shrunk in a very specific way that shows up on this NeuroQuant test. The VCS is a very, very simple test. You're just looking for shades of gray. So you see, the test makes you see the lines going either upwards, left or right, and you basically answer a multiple choice question which way they're seeing, and they will fade the grays until they get closer and closer. People with a biotoxin illness, be it from mold or exposure to, say, dinoflagellates, do you get dinoflagellates over here? We get these things in Tasmania where if you go into the water, they start glowing in the dark. No, they're really cool stuff, but they're toxic. They're toxic, actually.
No, we don't go in the water much.
That's right, yeah. Good reason not to. Yeah, but biotoxin illnesses affects your ability to see contrast. So people who are severely affected by mold, you will notice that they cannot tolerate very, very strong daylight. So if you're coming across customers or clients who actually cannot tolerate strong daylight, I would suspect mold illness is one of them. But then for a VCS test, they are free online ones. They're not the most accurate, but this is a bit of a screening test, and it's good enough for you to decide whether you want to spend money to do the other tests. Blood biomarkers test. This is another one because your body goes through inflammation. There are certain markers that show up more, and you've got certain profiles because certain hormones are particularly high and other hormones are very low. So this is not at all random, and it is not at all in your head. There is very objective test to show that you've got these illnesses. Right. So first thing, when you have mold illness, go out of a moldy building. There is no doctor who is familiar with mold illness who would encourage you to stay on in the building. There is no chance that you can recover. No amount of medication, no amount of detox is going to get it out of you. You've got to get rid of the source. So you remove yourself from the buildings. So this has got to be a health issue. This is specific to Tasmania, but I think common sense and common law should apply this across to all places. The person that is entitled to make a determination whether a building is so unhealthy, it is prejudicial to the well-being of the occupants, must be the EHOs, environmental health officers. This was a draft written. The reason I am showing it is because I thought this draft was actually better written than the final copy that went out. They have really made the link between substandard housing and poor health. So in a sense, we are actually burying a head in our sense to say that substandard housing doesn't have a condensation problem, doesn't have a mold problem. The EHOs have already figured this out. Next thing they say that it's not just damp from the ground. Condensation. Relatively pure water, and we're talking about distilled water because condensate is pretty much distilled water. That is the prime fodder for mold growth. They like that. Salt actually inhibits their growth. So if you treat something with salt, let's say if you've got a rammed earth wall, that is very resistant to mold growth. But other things where you've taken out the salts, let's say a paper-backed gypsum board, things like LVL, where you've got the glues as well, and the glues is also, it's got the starches and the sugar that's mold food. You just add condensation to that, and away mold grows. Now, the final version that got published was this copy. Mark mentioned about various PPEs that are required to clear 1 square meter, 3 square meters, and so forth. So they had this guidelines of less than 1 square meter, 10 square meters, and more than 10 square meter. My first issue to the EHO is, do you know where to look? It's not on the plasterboard, it is behind. It is not on your ceiling. You've got to get inside the roof and start pulling back insulation to find it. You've got to start pulling back cladding to find it. Do you know where to look? Where do you get your 10 square meters? So that is a big issue. Now the next big issue is that all this doesn't have a different outcome. For this, refer to the decision-making flow chart. Now this is a bit hard to read, so I'll read this to you. So the Public Health Act in Tasmania says that the EHO is made to make this decision that it is likely to become offensive, injurious, or prejudicial to health, and they are so unhealthy that no person can safely occupy them. First category, not so unhealthy that no person can safely occupy them, and not so unhealthy that no person can safely occupy them. So yes, it's all legal jargon, but they are not giving you any guidance. Which one is 1 square meter, 10 square meter, and more than 10 square meter? We actually don't know. So who makes the decision? The EHO is left out there. And if anyone were to sue them, guess what they're going to say? They have no basis to make those decisions unless they are specially trained in molds. So what is the safest thing to say? There is no problem. Now this has been picked up before. So statutory decision making in Tasmania, this was brought up. Unless an officer possesses diagnostic skills, it may be very difficult to carry out an efficient and productive legislation search to identify potentially useful provisions. We are not giving them guidance. We are basically hanging them out there if anyone were to sue them. And so they are not empowered to make any decisions. So the most likely thing they're going to say is that I don't see a problem. And they don't want to find a problem. Because if they find a problem, they've got to stand behind those decisions. It is tough on them. So here we are stuck with. So they've got to employ the techniques of lawyers, courts, and tribunals used to interpret legislation. So which EHO do you know has the time to do that in the area of mold? So without this, without making the health link, that's where we are stuck. That's why I'm saying that we can't do this until the whole legislation moves forward. And until that happens, it's really left up to people like you who understand the science of evaporation and condensation to be able to tell people, this is right, that's wrong, just listen to me. You don't understand, just listen to me. Next things, what are your legal rights? This one you want to pay attention. If you've got mold in your house, who do you call other than Mark?
Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. Here, that, if I were to advertise myself as Moldbuster, do you trust me? Do you know what qualification I need?
None.
You have no clue, isn't it? You go Google and you find that all the standards are competing. There is no Australian standard about remediation. There is no Australian standard about the qualifications for a remediator. You can find that even the most basic traits require a certain certification. But when it comes to mold remediation, it's cowboy land. Right, so here we go. You've got mold. And this is our pitch to people who are tenants and house owners. Evidence that all boils down to that. If you need to go to a tribunal, they need evidence. So it can't be your word against somebody else that somebody else's. Clean it with precaution, dispose, document. Kind of commonsensical, but let me come to the big thing. If you're a tenant, what are your options? Now, we did this as a kind of a center spread. So the easiest option is to end your tenancy and leave. Now, I'm saying this as a very, very viable option. Why? You're just giving up your bond. Right? Give up your bond, leave the place, end of story. Or if you want to fight, let's see how long this rabbit hole goes. Right? So you can refer to your Residential Tenancies Act. Mark already mentioned, and we've seen many Tenancies Act, mold is the responsibility of the homeowner. So they're already covering themselves there. They've stated it. You can sue. You can say that is unconstitutional, but that is another fight. On paper, they've already said that this, you have signed that. You've agreed that mold is your responsibility. Most of the tenancy acts will already have that. It is the homeowner's responsibility. I dispute that. I think it should be the building fabric's responsibility, especially if it's a design or a detailing problem. Let's go further down. If you don't want that, you write a letter to the landlord. Very few of them would be accommodating to do a test for you. So you got to test it yourself. Now, how many tests do you run? You are the brightest people in the room here. How many tests do you run?
One. Three.
Yeah. It's tricky, isn't it? What happens is that I knew of a case in Queensland. She tested one room. After that, the landlord refunded her 1/6 of a rental, because there were 6 other spaces that she didn't test.
Fair enough.
How much is a test? Starts from $300 onwards. Yeah, depending on what you want to identify. If you're only identifying to the genus through a microscope, $300. If you want to identify down to the species, you need to do a DNA test. That is closer to $800. So you do that, still not satisfied. You go to the state tribunal, and then you got to ask yourself that question. Do you have the cash? Can you take it one step further to go to the magistrate court? See, what do you think this amount is when you start going to that level of suing somebody? Would I ballpark $40,000? If it's less than that, don't bother. If you can't sue for that amount, and can you sue a landlord for that amount? Not a chance. So you've got to see that getting up and going, that actually, to many people, is actually a very viable solution. Mark and I sometimes like to tell people, you're better off demolishing and rebuilding. We don't know how to tell them that. But we think that is probably the most viable solution sometimes. Now, homeowners, check your insurance policy. And this is where it gets really good. Because every insurer I've checked has got an exclusion clause. Mold ain't covered. So they're specifically not covering for mold. So you can say, I've got flood damage, fine. They replace the flood damage. But if you didn't clear the flood damage in time and that spread onto mold damage to your clothes and so forth, ain't covered. They're covering you for what? A listed event. So they've got when you sign up your policies, there are listed events that you're covering against. One of those that we think is bizarre is terrorist listed event. You really hope you're going to claim on that because you charge you the premiums for that. But you've got a listed event. It's got to be tied to the event and then you can claim. Condensation is a design problem. There is no listed event. Condensation happens all the time. You can't make a listed event out of it. So you see where you are? The insurance policy is never going to cover you for condensation and mold damage. Mold exclusions, as far as I've read, every major insurer out there does have that, so you can't. So you've got to take that to court. So once again, do you have that 40 grand to spare? Next option, consult a mold remediator. So already, our bright guys here, you wouldn't know who to call. You almost have to call somebody who's in the line who can tell you this fella's a cowboy, that person is decent. Right? Because these things aren't regulated. You can try to check the qualifications. What do you look out for? What qualification is there? Somebody calls himself a mold expert. I'll call myself Dr. Mold or Mold Buster. What's the difference? You wouldn't know. There is no regulation. It's not like we enjoy certain regulations calling yourself, say, a professional engineer. Not everybody gets to call themselves a professional engineer. Somebody calls themselves a lawyer or an architect. These terms are protected by law. Not everybody can call themselves that. But everyone can call themselves a mold expert or a mold consultant or an indoor air consultant or indoor environment professional. There are other things that are a bit more difficult, like a hygienist and so forth. Yes, those things are regulated. But really, unless you know what is the difference between a hygienist, a mycologist, and a toxicologist. You understand? That's where the homeowners are stuck. They don't know what to do. And if you're suffering from mold illness and brain fog, you are even in a tougher situation. I don't have a good solution out there. I'm just trying to let you know how bad the situation is in Australia. Who can help you? I'm just putting out a few names there. Yes, a certified industrial hygienist, these terms are regulated. Indoor air quality specialist, that isn't regulated. They're trying to reterm that indoor environment professional and trying to put some qualifications around that. But I did tell the guys that, look, I can call myself an architectural professional. You can call yourself an architectural professional. You aren't contradicting the law. You're only contradicting the law when you say you are an architect. You realize the difference? So you can call yourself an architectural and engineering professional for all you want. Yeah. So these terms, unless people know what the law is, they don't know what they're buying into and what's being sold to them. My colleges, there are only about a handful of them in Australia. Some in Sydney, some in Victoria, and some in Western Australia. I haven't come across any in Northern Territory yet. Toxicologists, I think only one or two in Australia. Right? You can find board certified construction experts all over the places. Building surveyors, they are board certified. The law allows them to make a determination what needs to be done to fix a building. But I haven't met a building surveyor that understands psychrometry. Agree? So you're kind of stuck. They don't know thermal bridging. They don't understand dew points. They certainly don't know about water activity. So where do they start in fixing a building? So whilst the law has these people out there as so-called the professionals, we don't actually have the real implementation of all this. Now bear with me, moldy buildings, this is where the kicker comes in, right? Does the buildings have this? Visible mold growth, we're telling you that is the tip of the iceberg. 90% of the mold is going to be behind what is visible. Strong mildew, dew and odors. By the time you can smell it, actually it's pretty bad. Do you know that the most sensitive equipment out there can't do what a sniffer dog can do? So sniffer dogs can pick up trace amounts of mycotoxins, those are the mold toxins, that none of our instruments can. So odors, if you start honing your skills, that would be your best friend. You can sniff these things out. Visible water damage. By the way, Mark and I are staying in the cave and it smells like a moldy building. Yep. So once you got that, you are safe to assume. Because one out of our three buildings we already know has visible condensation issues. All buildings already have condensation problems. If you can smell mold, you are on the money. You've got a mold problem. So what causes that? Now the first point here, I'm saying is occupant behavior, but at the same time, I struggle with this issue. Occupant behavior can change things drastically. At the same time, it shouldn't be relied upon. We shouldn't be packing people into this hall and telling people, you know what, you can only breathe once every 10 seconds, otherwise we don't have enough oxygen here. We shouldn't be doing that. As many people as we can pack inside here, the HVAC system should take care of that. Agreed? So as much as you can live in your building, that building should take care of itself. People living there normally should be able to live normally. I take cold showers because I'm a geek. And I know that the water coming out of the Tasmanian taps is colder than dew point. So I'm dehumidifying the toilet as I shower in cold showers. But how many people can shower in cold showers in Tasmania? Look, yeah, this is bizarre. Yes, occupant behavior can save the situation, but it shouldn't be your first port of call. Unfortunately, we have all these buildings with problems already built. What are we going to do? We can put dehumidifiers inside. That is one solution. But occupant behavior has got to be one of the solutions, isn't it? I don't like to say this, but unfortunately, I think we've got to accept that for now, for Australia, we've got to start telling people, you've got to change your behavior. One of those things you've got to change, don't make your bed. When you make your bed, the sun doesn't reach your mattress. You don't allow the mattress to dry out. The humidity that has built up over the night doesn't get to evaporate. Can you imagine the campaign that we go through to tell people how to behave over their whole lives so that they can live in our moldy buildings, our condensation-prone buildings? It is big. I don't know how to save the situation, but I'm just letting you know that that is a tricky one, but that looks like all that we have for now. It could be faulty building, it could be natural disaster. Now these things, you are more than familiar with those things. Let's say you don't get hail damage here, but you get cyclone damage. Those things could pull apart flashing, water could run behind that. You get faulty buildings and so forth. I'm less concerned about that because I think the market is quite well informed about leaky water ingress into buildings. What they are less informed about is how vapor migrates across different membranes and where it starts building up. So for us in Tasmania, we're concerned about vapor building up as it tries to migrating out of the building. For you, the coldest point is the cooling coils of the fan coil units. So you make the path from the outside in, and anytime you pass a vapor impermeable membrane, that's where you got problems. For example, vinyl wallpaper, that would be a big problem. The other one I look out for is waterproofing membranes. If they're not vapor permeable and you've got coal on one side and the vapor cannot go through, it's going to condense on those membranes. Another area I look at is big mirrors, big whiteboards. If it was cold here, warm outside there, behind this whiteboard would be all moldy. Because the cold hits this cold surface, it gets cold. The warmth on the other side provides a vapor source, it condenses behind the whiteboards, behind big mirrors. It should be occurring behind built-in wardrobes and so forth too. So once again, these are the tricky places. You can't find them unless you know where to look. A brief look at what we can do, but I won't go too much into this because this is very much focused on the Tasmanian climate. Lots of things we can do too, but once again, these are focused on the Tasmanian climate. But what I hope I have come about in this long journey is to show you that we need your psychometric skills to understand condensation problems. These problems are widespread, and for now, we have no easy fix. So my tagline to you is mold is somebody's problem and nobody's business. Very unfortunately, please don't get in the first place. Thank you, guys.